Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
And Quick,
Moses Snedis,
Imran Siddiqui,
and Makula.
With guest co-host Joe, Snoopy369 Matisse.
This is John Schaefer, designer and programmer at Firaxis Games. Like me, you're listening to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
That sounded like a whip in the background.
That was just me opening a soda.
What the hell?
Problem comes along, you must whip it.
Introductions.
You know, since Mackie is currently leading the favorite co-host, I think her admirers would like to hear more. It's true. Mackie doesn't talk enough, so here you go.
Mackie doesn't talk enough. Well, sometimes I just don't have anything to say. Or just be, me too. Which... you'd be filler and you'd have to cut it anyway.
What, there are two of you now?
No.
Well, that means we got to divide her votes in half. I win!
You are desperate to win, aren't you? Welcome to Polycast, official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. I'm Makalua. I think Imran's here still.
Yep.
And Locutus.
Uh-oh.
He's fallen asleep at the wheel.
Hi.
Is Dan still here?
Tron. Oh!
With us also, Snoopy369.
Hello.
And I'm ahead of him running the favorite host poll. Ha ha.
No!
Barbarians founded a religion.
Yes! Thracian founded Judaism.
That is cool. Do it more often, do it more often.
And the first post to set it up, I guess he traded world map, and Judaism, holy city, was barbarian. It was Thracian. Mm. And the next post is, Zionist conspiracy? Question mark. One of the theories was perhaps one of the other civs had took over Thrace, founded Judaism in it, and then had it taken over by barbarians again.
Yeah, but the original guy was saying he'd looked through the log and he'd never seen anyone take over the city, so they really did it.
Yay!
I did notice some later down in the thread had mentioned that they have taken out the ability for barbarians to build wonders. I liked it when barbarians built wonders. It was so cool.
Well, especially when you have...
Terra map.
Yeah, when you have barbarians on the other side of the world building their own civilizations and cities that are just as good as the ones on the other side. And they should have wonders.
Yeah, they're basically their own civilization.
Yep.
They were only barbarian because, well, you called them that.
Exactly.
Gee, that's not like the real world at all.
And how ethnocentric of us.
Yeah.
I like it. That's kind of fun. I think they should be able to build wonders, too. I think that's a good idea.
In the episode discussion thread for episode 29, Welder got his first groupie.
Ooh. Oh!
Apparently, China Blue out there, she likes listening Welder speak English with his Dutch accent.
Woohoo!
I figured that this was an important occasion, and it should be marked accordingly. So, I have my own cake of a song, which I like to call C-I-V-V-I-N-G.
That's where I hit the mute button.
That's where we all hit mute.
Locutus and China Blue sitting in a tree. C-I-V-V-I-N-G. First come warriors, then come tanks, then comes a little one to join their ranks. Woo!
I hope it didn't take you very long to come up with that one.
Only the last line.
What rhymes?
That's right, I was. And all I could come up with originally was Spanx and Yanks, and I thought, this is a family-friendly show. In the news, we combine first hands-on Civilization Revolution previews and Death Monkey speaking on the upcoming game. Over in the modcast, resources in production, speed up, not allow, or deny, espionage economy in Civilization IV Beyond the Sword, mounted units underrated, and kick levies to the curb. In the Senate, best start a technology combination in Civ IV, working with coal, and moving your capital?
Hmm?
Do you?
Yeah?
Do you?
Hmm?
Bleh.
Bleh. Bleh, bleh, bleh. Bleh,
bleh. Mackie's been doing this show too long now, too.
Indeed.
Bleh, 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 bleh.
the news?
News.
News.
The new Civrev, Civrev, Civrev.
This is Civrev Cast.
Yes.
I think the Wii version would be a bit weird.
Weird?
It doesn't have as many buttons. I mean, yeah, you can do it kind of pointerish, and that's kind of interesting and all, but...
Doesn't it have more buttons between the two different controllers?
I didn't think so. I thought it had less.
Because you've got the joystick pointer thingy in the right hand, and then you have the other thing in the left hand.
Yeah, you have the, whatchamacallit, the,
Wiimote.
The nunchuck and the...
the nunchuck.
The what? The nunchuck. Yeah, but I thought that ended up overall in less buttons. Because I think there's two on the, whatchamacallit, the pointer thing, and then how many are there on the other one? The PlayStation and the Xbox 360 have about 8 buttons on them.
More than that, actually, but...
Well, whatever. But they have a bunch of buttons.
Needed on Polycast. People who have consoles and can go look at them. And go, oh, this many buttons. Okay.
Yes, but I don't have the Wii console, so I don't know. Because I would think for Civ, you would need a lot of buttons.
I think that's the point of Civ, is to get around the whole too many buttons thing. And
There was actually related right to this first set of articles here from Death Monkey, who's talking about CivRev from the depths of the Firaxis offices. Someone mentioned about keyboard and mouse support for the PS3. But Death Monkey says that that's highly unlikely. We've invested a great deal of development time getting the game playing well with the normal controllers for the systems, and we're happy with our current solution. Says he'd be interested in supporting this if we had another 6 months or a year, but at this point I want to get the game out the door so I can share it with people.
Well, Death Monkey also said he believes, but don't quote him on it, that Sid has stated this has been one of his favorite games to work on, and one of the best games that Death Monkey's had a chance to work on, so high praise.
Indeed. And since Death Monkey says he wants to share it with people, it sounds like there's going to be one copy of the game available for each platform, and everyone has to take turns.
What Death Monkey talks about, basically, they're also trying to replace the negative aspects with benefits, like such as happiness is provided by temples, cathedrals, and wonders, and they want to avoid penalizing the player, so they try to avoid things like unhappiness and things like...
Unhealthiness?
Yeah, yeah, and things like that, because they want to make sure that the player feels like they've lost because they've been outplayed rather than they were, quote, hosed by some esoteric rule, unquote.
Okay.
So they'll start out like at just a neutral level, and then if you build those things, they get happy. But if you don't build those things, you're just stuck with neutral guys, and they don't go into riots and stuff.
Basically, it sounds like.
Yeah. Later on, Death Monkey says, there's a number of Civ systems that have been historically correct but not particularly enjoyable. For example, food production and consumption for cities. Civ made it where cities only grow when they generate food. If they don't generate food, nobody starves, but the city doesn't grow either.
I'm not sure I like that. I understand what they're trying to do and make it a shorter game and not be overly frustrating and whatnot, but I think there has to be consequences in some respects to not being able to feed your people.
Well, they'll probably say the consequence is your city stops growing.
Yeah, but even then, what if you decide, well, the city's big enough, I'm just going to make it all go to mining and whatnot, and I'm making a mining city or whatever. I don't know if you can in the middle, but say I want to make it mining and forget about food, and say you just kind of destroy all your food production and say, well, they're not growing. That's the only downside there is. Seems kind of weak.
Thinking a little too simplified?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it just sounds like there should be some negatives, or else it just sounds too pre-settler.
Pre-settler.
Yeah, if I take away just about all negatives, and everything is either neutral or positive, and it just seems kind of...
There's still negatives. I mean, there's always the negative in that you choose growing versus not growing, and assuming that there's some penalty to not growing, assuming that there's something that makes it better to grow than to not grow, there's still a negative. It's just, it doesn't look negative. It doesn't look unhappy. But it's still a negative in that you're not growing anymore, so you're doing hammers instead. The question is, how do they deal with that in later game? And that's always been the problem in games in general, is things that are difficult strategic choices in the early game are no longer difficult strategic choices in the late game. Because, yes, just like in Civ 4, you build a worker at the beginning, or you grow your first couple cities up as fast as possible by farming them, and then later in the game, do you do something else to cause them to not grow as fast anymore? Well, of course in the later game you do, because by the time they're size 20, who cares if they grow anymore unless they're the great person city? So I think that, no different from that, it's just that it's moved up a little bit. The strategic choice, instead of being more towards the, okay, you want a sort of generalist city that does some hammers and some food and some commerce, is now no longer really a good choice anymore. Now it's you want all of your cities to be specialized because there's no real penalty being specialized, whereas there is a penalty in Civ 4.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty will more be where your city is located now. Because whereas in Civ 4, you can do something with almost any location. You can use almost any location to do something interesting, whether that's just commerce or whatever. But in Civ, a location that's lots of hammers and no food is going to be basically useless because you won't be able to grow your city up at all. And a city spot that's lots of food and no hammers is, again, going to be basically useless because you can grow it up real big, but it can't ever do any hammers.
Mm-hmm.
But a city that's got, let's say, 4 really good food squares and then a whole bunch of hammer squares is going to be a whole lot better because you can grow it up as fast as possible with those 4 food squares and then say, okay, well, I'm done with food now. Let's just do all hammers and use whatever 8 or 9 population you've built all on hammers. So I think it'll be a little more towards that specialization, whereas a city that's got 4 food squares and 4 hammer squares and 4 commerce squares isn't going to be quite as interesting because you don't need those food squares once you've finished growing. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll find out when we play the game, but...
The territory grab portion of the game is quite short, and you're more focused on the victory goals earlier than you were before, quote-unquote, and I think we had touched upon that. Plays faster, you're able to fill up the map more quickly, whatever that size of the map is, so the territory grab portion is shorter. And it continues, quote, I know this has been said before, but I feel that the victory goals are far more interesting and clear than they have been in the past. The space victory and conquest victory return in a recognizable shape, unquote. I didn't know that the conquest victory was not a recognizable shape in, say, Civ 4, but okay. Civ Rev was developed from the ground up for consoles, and it's been over 10 years since Sid designed a Civilization game. He's cherry-picked many of the best ideas from the games he didn't work on and strengthened elements of Civ 1.
All right. Dinosaurs.
That's from the games he didn't work on it, man. Death Monkey says that specifically for his type of play, it takes about 90 minutes to finish a game, but he says that's more about my play speed than my talent. Those who want to micromanage every city will have longer games.
I like micromanaging to a certain degree. I imagine that you can have longer games on the console. I don't see why that necessarily should be a province of the PC version, but I guess they're going for a preference for a shorter, quick game.
From the GameSpot preview, first great wonder available is to build Stonehenge. If you construct Stonehenge before everyone else, and presumably because it's a great wonder, you've been able to build it before everyone else because no one else has built it. But anyway, if you construct Stonehenge before everyone else, it will grant you a bonus to all the temples in your cities, and that helps push your culture upon your neighbors and expand your borders.
Ew.
Woo! We might have known about the Stonehenge particulars before, but I didn't think it was necessarily the first wonder that was available, comparable to Civ 4.
Sounds exactly like Civ 4.
Yay! See, there we go. All the particular cherry-picking from Civ titles that Sid didn't work on, he put in the game. See? Naysayers.
Nay.
We had learned about the culture of victory before and how the culture of victory uses great people. Specifically, according to this, you can get a culture of victory by either recruiting at least 20 great people from history, or you can get a culture of victory by flipping or converting enough enemy cities to your side. Peacefully. Great people can provide cities with massive improvements in their outputs or even steal an entire enemy city. That sounds...
a little too powerful.
Wow. Influence, okay, to culturally come over to this, but actually steal an entire enemy city? I wonder if that's just...
That sounds like Civ 3 or Civ 2 spying.
I didn't even notice.
The tech tree is almost identical to the one found in the PC games, except for the later stages. There are fewer advanced technologies missing our techs like recycling and lasers, and Firaxis hopes that this will help streamline the end of the game.
Nearly identical to which PC version? There's a couple of differences.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he's referring to specifically Civ 4, and he's just thinking of that as the PC game.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite parts. If you discover a new river or major geographical feature, you can also, in addition to naming it, get a gold reward. As GameSpot's Jason Ocampo reports, and the IGN article says something similar to that, too. Interesting. Dan's River.
Woohoo!
Then you have these annoying names on the map.
I can already do that in Alpha Centauri. I didn't get rewards for it, but I can name things, funny things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can do it in Civ 4 as well. Only nobody does it.
There was an oopsie in this article, this IGN one, though. He says, the caravan functions the same as in Civ 4. Oops.
Got left the caravan, definitely. Assume you mean Civ 2 there?
Yes.
Is he a Civ player?
I don't know.
Have you ever played Civ before?
I recognize the Jason Ocampo name, but I don't ever remember coming across this Brudvig individual. But he's still doing better than Eliza. Did I bring that up again? When he says with the caravan, I guess he thinks this is a similar function to Civ 4. Maybe he's getting them confused somehow with the great merchant, great person, but that's not even quite the same. But we'll cut him some slack. He is a console person, after all, I think.
Oh, you brought that up again.
Caravan functions the same as in Civ 4, although the city that is visited also gets a cash bonus in the form of a tax, removing the one-sided trading affair that existed before.
That does sound like the Civ 2 system.
Sounds like sort of combining the Civ 2 system with the Civ 4 trade route system, though.
Yeah.
Which I don't know, but I like the Civ 4 one better.
I just hope that with the caravan unit, we'll have the ability to select what exactly it is that they are going to export. As I remember correctly from Civ 2, you build a caravan, but you didn't necessarily know what it was going to include. Wasn't it just randomized? You couldn't choose that.
Yeah, I think so. There is a classic controller, but for the Wii, so if they decided to...
All right.
It looks like it works with the Wiimote. So you can have the Wiimote in one hand and the classic controller in the other, or just be using the classic controller and still be able to use the Wiimote if there's something useful that it does. Like, they connect together, so...
Wiimote makes me giggle.
I imagine that one of the difficulties with Civ on the PlayStation or on the Xbox is selecting units. You probably need to have several different buttons and such.
Well, I mean, not necessarily.
At minimum, you need to use one of the analogs. At minimum, you have to use one of the analog sticks.
Yeah. I mean, I assume you just use the analog.
If you don't, you have to use the analog stick for the Wii, because you can just point to it and select it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got each analog stick is worth 8 buttons right there, because each direction on the analog stick can be a different button, essentially. It can have a different function.
I think the analog stick won't be too difficult to actually use as a pointer device.
Right, yeah. I'm just saying I think that it gets you more buttons. I mean, the Wiimote has a 4-directional pointer on it. That's 4 buttons. Plus the 2 more buttons it's got, so that's 6. And then the Nunchuck has 2 more buttons, so that's 8. That's the same amount as the PlayStation has plus the second analog stick. So... I think it'll work fine.
The GameSpot hands-on preview, they specifically mention they've got the Xbox 360 in front of them, and says the right analog stick basically moves the cursor around the map while the face buttons let you select units and issue commands. Select a military unit, for instance, and you can order it to fortify in position by hitting the X button, or tell it to wait for one more turn by hitting the B button. If a unit is already fortified, for example, or in sentry mode, you can activate it by hitting the A button. It says you can also toggle through units by using the left and right bumpers.
Mm.
Left and right bumpers? You mean the triggers?
Yeah, it's...
No, the bumpers. The left bumper and the right bumper above the triggers.
Yeah, sort of on the front.
So the second triggers.
Yeah.
And I don't have an Xbox, so I'm probably not using that. I mean, the standard controller since the PS2 is it's got 4 buttons on the top, it's got 2 analog sticks, it's got 1 D-pad, and then it's got 4 triggers on the front. Is that essentially the same thing, but you're calling the top 2 bumpers, or are there 6 triggers on the front?
Well, I guess with the PS3 button, I guess there's 2 analog sticks, and there is a D-pad on it.
Standard gamepad controller since the PS2, basically, since the PS2, not the beginning of the PS2. It's just the same as the standard PC game controller at this point that I've got in my hand. It has 4 buttons, you know, your X, Y, Z, A, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, right?
The 2 analog sticks in the middle, the 1 D-pad up on the upper left, and it's got like the start buttons in the middle or whatever. And then it's got 4 triggers on the front. Is that the same thing for the Xbox? So you're calling the top 2 triggers bumpers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I guess with the Xbox One, the bottom 2 triggers are actually more recessed a little bit.
Ah.
So it actually feels more like a trigger.
But essentially the same thing. Really, everything else, the only other complications will be the menus. And again, with the Wii being able to point to spots on the menu instead of having to use different buttons to do different menu functions, you know, I honestly think the Wii will be better at it. From what I recall, they're not going to have normal workers, right?
I think it's going to be more of a, what was it, the call to power thing?
Yeah, they call it a power style system. Where this system has been whether you say, you know, I want this to be irrigated or just...
Well, according to the hands-on preview on IGN by Eric Brudvig, workers will automatically go about their business. You can still dig down into the city and micromanage them a bit if you want one town to focus on a particular resource or build a road.
Okay, that makes sense. So basically you tell the city to be a hammer city and then the worker will mine instead of windmill or whatever.
Yeah, if they even have windmills anymore.
Well, probably not. Yeah, but I mean, it'll focus on making hammer improvements instead of food improvements or whatever if you tell it to.
Yeah.
When it comes to tiles in Civ Rev, you can only build one improvement per tile. That doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't.
That makes sense. If there's only one kind of improvement per tile, that makes more sense for the simplified gameplay. Sounds like they're almost sticking very close to the original Civ stuff, which sort of surprises me. I feel like if I were designing a control set for the Xbox 360 or whatever, I would have one of the analog sticks just move the unit, not have to activate it or deactivate it or whatever. I mean, you'd have, you know, a Fortify. Probably wouldn't have Sentry. I'd probably have Fortify and Sentry be sort of the same thing. I'd probably have it automatically wake up if it saw a bad guy and force you to refortify it again. Or maybe, I don't know. But I would definitely have one of the analog sticks just, if that unit is selected, move that unit no matter what, no matter what it's currently doing. I would try to take away that level of having to activate it. Even in Civ 4, you don't have to activate it. You just directly move it. It's fortified, and you tell it to move, it moves.
Yeah.
I think that that's sort of surprising that they would have all those different options.
If it's fortified, you have to activate the unit because it won't go through your regular cycle.
Well, right, but in Civ, you activate it, and you select it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Civ Rev, assume you have to select it somehow. Right?
Well, I guess...
You have to select it, which is the same thing as activating.
That's what the A button is for.
Well, no, but it sounds like the A button individually activates it. Like, takes a unit that you've already selected and then activates it.
You put the pointer over it, and then you hit the A button, and the A button's like a mouse click. It sounds like the same to me as you would do it in Civ 4. Like, you move your mouse pointer over it, and then you click the button to try to activate the fortified unit.
I wouldn't use the left analog stick as a mouse pointer. I would use it like tab. In whichever direction you pointed, it would go to the nearest thing there. So that's probably where I would use one of the triggers. If you hold one of the triggers down, then it becomes a cursor. Seems to me like the most efficient use is to just go from unit to unit to unit, or from unit to city or whatever, you know, to the next nearest interesting thing, as opposed to automatically, because that seems more commonly useful than moving a cursor around, which takes a while. And if you want any degree of specificity with that cursor, you have to make that cursor move relatively slowly. You can't make it move really, really fast, because a mouse... You've got fast moves and slow moves with your mouse. With analog stick, you don't really have as much of that.
Well, you can. I mean, if you put it all the way, it moves fast. But if you do it a little bit...
Yeah, I mean, you have that's why it's analog. But it's still not nearly as much as a mouse. A mouse has a much higher range of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an analog stick, it really only has... Realistically, you can only really have 3 or 4 different speeds.
True, but...
And most people can't even get the slow speed. Most people really have... Probably.
What I think they're doing with the left analog stick is doing what they do with first-person shooters, which is make it into, like, mouse movement. I think they're going for just the kind of general, almost accepted way of PC-ish type of game on the console with an analog stick.
I wouldn't have done that. I mean, I suppose to some extent you want to stick as close to the FPS controls as possible, because that's what people are used to. But, I don't know, just to me it seems like it would have been better to go with a more Civ-specific, something that's a little more appropriate for Civ.
A favorite new feature is the ability to retreat from combat when attacking. You keep your remaining units alive, but the defender gets a free promotion. So as opposed to the possibility of retreating from combat when on defense, you now have the ability to do that when attacking? Although, was there not some degree of that in Civ 4 as well?
In Civ 4, it's an automatic thing. I mean, if you're down to your last hit point, you may or may not withdraw. And here it seems it's like Call to Power 2. You really have a button that you can press, okay, this battle is going badly, let's get out of here. And in Call to Power 2, it was really unbalanced, because it's something the human can do, but the AI can't. It'd be interesting to see how they're going to deal with that in Civ Rev.
Actually, in the GameSpot preview, Compo says, talks about this, actually, the ability to retreat if, in a sense, if the battle is going badly. We managed to pull the army back by hitting the B button to order a retreat. Then we withdrew the army to friendly territory and had it heal in place over the course of several turns. So again, another link to the controller. Of course, we've also been talking about a lot with Civ Rev, the different versions, just what differences are there going to be, and Death Monkey is emphasizing that you've got the same rule set and the same gameplay, but he does say that the DS version is by far the fastest Civ game to date, and by far the fastest even in comparison to the 360, the PS3, and the Wii. Maybe that's because by the nature of it being handheld.
Yeah. Well, and also the graphics probably aren't as, how should I say, cutting edge on the DS. They don't intend them to be. Because I think if you look at some of the screenshots, they're trying to catch the eye of people who have a 360 or a PS3 also by graphics as well as, look, it's Civ on the console. On a DS, I don't think there's all that much pressure to do that.
Similar to the graphics consideration on the DS, on the Wii version, Death Monkey says, again, same rule set, but the interface could be the best of all of them. Oh, he says some platforms do things better than others. Having a full high-definition display for the 360 and PS3 certainly doesn't hurt. The pretty graphics and,
ooh, pretty.
And important to me,
shiny,
woo, shiny. And Death Monkey also says, but more important for him is the amount of information that can be displayed. The touch screen works great for the DS when manipulating the unit stack quickly.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that would go.
I can see that.
Are we done with Death Monkey?
Yes.
I think we've exhausted Death Monkey.
Post here! Got news? Email news at apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy369, Alexander the First, or Luminatus via Polton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
Modcast time?
Yep.
Yay! Woo!
Welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Sue.
Resources and production feed up, not allow or deny Levger. Basically, I guess he kind of wonders if the resource system is sort of bunk, like how having a copper tile is required to build Axeman. And he thinks it's very uncommon for a sieve to not have some copper reserves or something like that. And I guess his problem is he thinks that some resources everyone should really have, or make it a little bit easier to build things that require certain resources.
I think he's saying that to allow copper to still be useful, rather than saying you cannot build an Axeman if you don't have copper, saying copper works like stone and that copper makes Axeman 50% faster or something. I see where he's coming from, although I strongly disagree with this, since I felt the resources are too weak and so forth. For the problem is that if you have no copper or iron in a multiplayer game, you are not going to win. You're going to lose, and you're probably going to lose very quickly, unless you're like the Khmer or something and have elephants under you and can just zoom right to that as fast as possible. That's sort of unfun in the sense that if you have no real chance at winning without copper or iron, yeah, that's not really very fun. But on the other hand, it's a strategic decision. There's a real strategic decision where copper and iron are important and you have to go get them if you don't have them. Your only real strategic decision if you don't have copper and you don't have iron is to build as many chariots as you're humanly capable of building and go get rid of somebody else who's got copper or iron before they build up enough spearmen to beat your chariots. And actually, it makes a real strong argument for just going straight to horsemen or to chariots in the first place, because that way you can start building those chariots while you're looking for your iron if you find you don't have copper. It makes that decision a strategic decision, as opposed to if it's just 50% faster Axeman, well, yeah, I'd like that 50% faster Axeman, but am I really going to go try to take somebody else out, which will cost a huge amount of expense on my part, just to get copper when it's only an improvement, as opposed to making it possible for me to let survive in the first place? I don't like it.
Yeah, and I think the other part of it, what he doesn't like, is that it cuts off so completely. If somebody pillages it or takes it over, and you should still have at least some reserve, at least, like, if you were building an Axeman unit, you should be able to finish it instead of it automatically switching to something non-Axeman.
It's the whole thing where people want realism. People want Civ to be this perfectly realistic game where every single thing is exactly how it is in real life. And that's not fun. Real life is not fun. I mean, in real life, we all go to jobs and we do boring things or maybe somewhat interesting things. But ultimately, it's not fun. And that's why we have games, is that they're not like real life. So we can get rid of the things that are not fun and we can make them more fun. And I think that saying, you know, okay, let's cut off your copper now, which means that in 20 turns you won't be able to build an X-Men. Gameplay is fun because you do something and it instantly does something. It's not fun because you do something and in a long time it does something. I think that, yes, it sucks if you're the person who gets his copper cut off, but think from the other point of view. If I'm the person coming in to attack you and I'm like, oh, there's your copper, let's go attack it now. What's the incentive for me to wipe out that copper if 20 turns from now that means you can't build an X-Men? Not really very much, because wars, particularly in the early game where copper is particularly likely to get cut off, in the early game most wars don't last 20 turns. By 20 turns, they're done. They're either finished or they're at least decided who's going to win. Whereas, let's say I've got a copper and I've got the choice between building a city on the copper and building a city next to the copper. In current Civ, that copper is right next to my most likely enemy. I'm going to build right on that copper to make sure that I don't lose it, make sure he's forced to at least take that city, and hopefully I'll put a 6 or 7 archers or something in it. But if taking that copper away doesn't hurt me for 20 turns, I'm going to build it away from the copper so I can use the hammer. And I think that it takes away those strategic decisions as well as making it a lot harder to come to actually attack somebody.
On the same token, especially with something like copper or iron, I know this is a point where if it does have a cutoff point, it may, instead of having make it faster, may need more instances of copper and iron around the map. Because generally, like you say, yes, Civ isn't exactly like history, but a lot of it is very based on historical fact. That's what makes it fun as well. So something like horses wasn't everywhere, but copper and iron generally were available all over the world. So perhaps greater instances of it. I think he was more frustrated by the fact he never got copper or iron or things like that.
Yeah, but the number of instances, though, determines the gameplay. If copper and iron are readily available to everyone, why does it matter? You know, why make copper or iron necessary for Axiomen? I mean, if there's for a 7-player game 20 instances of copper and 20 instances of iron, yeah, I mean, the whole reason resources in Civ 4 are interesting is because you don't always have them, and you have to make do with what you have. So some games you have copper, some games you have horses, just like some games you have stone and some games you have marble. You know, with stone I build the pyramids, with marble I build the oracle. But that makes the game interesting. That's what makes the resource system useful. And if any system where you give everyone copper or give everyone iron, that makes it less interesting.
Perhaps.
It certainly can be a little unfun to be that person who's got no copper, but at the same time, maybe you should be chariot rushing people, or maybe you should be playing your game a little differently. Certainly there are some games where I start and I'm like, you know, I don't have any real chance to win the game, but maybe I can do this, and maybe that'll give me a better chance.
Well, I think most people, if they don't have copper or iron, will just quit the game and start up a new one. I know I probably
will.
I really don't think it's any fun at all, especially if you're denied copper or iron. And, I mean, it's just a bit ridiculous.
That's the single-player versus multiplayer game difference, too. In a multiplayer game, you can't.
Yeah.
So hopefully you don't just quit the game because you think you're not going to win right away, because then multiplayer games would be sort of silly. Particular multiplayer, that's what drives multiplayer, is the resource differential and saying, you know, oh, I don't have this resource and I think I want it, so let's go take it from this other guy. That's really what drives the game, and that's why I say, I mean, and the balance, the number of coppers and irons and such, that's always the balance, and that's always something that can be questioned, you know, is this exactly right balance? Maybe a little more copper, a little more iron, but I think that the idea of giving a ton more copper so that everyone has it, it makes them pointless. Why have resources in the first place? From what I remember of Civ 3, and it's been 18 billion years since I played it last, because I've tried to clear my memory of it entirely, the resource system went back and forth. Through the different patches, they had less and more and less again, I think. I don't remember where they ended up, where the final Civ 3 conquest patch ended up, but I remember it was that and the corruption thing were the two big balance, horrible, horrible balance things in Civ 3. I don't know. I mean, in Civ 4, you could easily, for a single-player game, anyhow, or for a multiplayer game played with a mod, you could easily adjust the amount of iron or copper generated. Mm-hmm. That's not hard at all. It's either an XML or a Python thing. I don't remember which, but you'll see a little number, and it'll be like iron this much and copper this much. You can just make that number a little bigger if you really want. So that's not hard at all, even though editing an XML file or a Python file might sound scary to someone. I mean, a notepad can do it. Mm-hmm. I think for the multiplayer game, the balance is pretty good. I think just from the multiplayer games that I've played, you know, I miss copper or iron maybe one time in 5, one time in 6. It's not enough to make it worth always chariot rushing, but it's enough to make chariot rushing interesting, at least possible. They also have an option, and I don't know if this is an option in single-player games or not, but in multiplayer games, a lot of the maps have a balanced resources option. It doesn't work perfectly, but it sort of does. It does something anyhow.
It's called gearing up and going to a war to obtain access to the resources you need then, or a trade, but that could be problematic. Either because of distances, or the trade network, or the AI is really quite hogging their strategic resources, or wants exorbitant terms, but yeah. I think the system is fine the way it is, and I actually like, someone pointed out, like, how do you build horse archers without any horses, or war elephants without elephants? This person complained specifically about needing copper for axemen. Perhaps we should remind him that you could use iron too?
I think he might know.
He craves metal.
Because, you know, I think that perhaps he probably realized that he can't build them.
I would have agreed with this guy in Civ 3, because there the problem was not with iron and copper, but with salt, pepper, and oil. And if you didn't have those, you were pretty much screwed, because everyone had their economies built up by that time, and you'd played 300 turns to find out that you don't have oil, and that pretty much means your game is over. Right now it happens much sooner in the game. People don't have their economies built up yet, so you have a chance to do a quick strike on someone with horses or with whatever you do have. Still, if that doesn't work or you don't like doing that, you still have the option to quit, and you didn't waste 300 turns for gameplay. So, yeah, I think this is a much better system, doing it just earlier in the game.
Yeah.
this person is taking the view that because you need certain resources to build particular units, it's a negative on your part, but it could also be a positive from your end if you find out, for example, that this person, or have reason to believe that this person only has access to one particular type of resource. That could be a strategy for attacking that opponent, even when you're in a position where a full frontal assault, taking their cities or even raising them, is not possible. You can just go in and pillage. So from that extent, perhaps there is this negative, if we want to call it that, from this position that, oh gosh darn, I don't have this resource within my cultural border. I can't expand here either because someone's going to grab that land before me because I'm going to go into debt, or there's nowhere else for me to go. Everyone's got the resources. I've got to go to war. Well, you may be able to turn it into a bit of a positive in a respect and actually do some precision strikes. I can't help but think about Sivrev, just when we say that, just because, again, they're emphasizing the things about, well, it's not a negative, it's either a neutral or a positive, and I think, generally speaking, that this is not a negative, this is just simply a circumstance you run into, and you're going to have to adapt, or you may be lucky, and maybe you're able to develop on your own, because you're by yourself.
All by myself.
Is it espionage economy time? If there is such a thing? I'm not convinced. Because as Bardolph asks, has anyone done any serious analysis of an economy that relies heavily on espionage as tech stealing as opposed to original research? How well would this work?
I've seen a few things on that. I think that it works okay. The biggest problem with it is you don't get to pick what's researched. You have to sort of rely on everyone else's research. You don't end up to specialize, essentially, because, you know, normally you could sort of pick to go down one particular line and get way ahead of everyone else and then trade it back. I think in a no-trading game, if you're playing a game where you can't trade or you're at least no tech brokering, I think that's a lot more powerful because then you can make sure and take techs that other people have researched that otherwise can't be traded back and forth. I think the biggest advantage of it is that it gives you the espionage option, so you can steal techs up to the point where you want a particular tech, and then you can start doing other espionage things like poisoning their wells, or, I mean, one of the big advantages of espionage, of course, is that you can take down their cultural defenses instantly, and not particularly expensively either, by sending them into revolt. If you send them into revolt, even if it's just for one turn, that's one turn where you get to attack at 0%. If you're going to be a warmonger, it might be a good idea, but if you're just going to be a regular builder or whatever, that's probably a bad idea.
So would you see trying to have this as an espionage-based economy, would that perhaps work better in the earlier game? You made that decision and then...
No.
No?
Later. Later game. Can't do it in the earlier game, of course. You don't have writing yet. But you wouldn't even do it just right when you have writing, because you'd still at that point probably need to build up your economy better. You'd probably wait until you had, I don't know, a printing press or something. And then you probably switch over. I think they mentioned it in the thread. Specialists are the real way to go, because espionage specialists are better than science specialists. Spy specialists get you more, particularly great spies will get you more than a great scientist will, I think. You do a whole lot of great spy specialists and try to get a whole lot of actual great spies and then use that to steal the appropriate tech.
I guess I was thinking earlier on in the game if you went with the Great Wall.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'd want to do the Great Spy Wonders if you could.
Because someone in this thread, they're arguing that combination at the beginning is far too powerful, and it says you can steal so much technology from one great spy that it feels dirty. That seems a bit of an overreaction.
You haven't done enough espionage to have anything to add, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mounted units underrated? Because the Sean Nakamura starts saying that the stable is not powerful enough and then goes into a bit of a discussion and then ultimately comes to the conclusion, you know what? I think mounted units are underrated, period.
Well, I don't think they're underrated so much later on when it's cavalry, because most people know, ooh, cavalry. That can really, yeah. But earlier, when you have the choice between, say, horse archers and macemen and things like that, and you go, well, maybe I should build a maceman. But horse archers, because of their retreat, can sometimes survive. There's usually, especially when you get to longbowmen, or if you have a heavily culturally defended city and you can't take it all down, when you have to make that first attack, there's always some defenders that are really hard to get down. And that's where the horse archers come in useful, because they can at least get their hit points down, but they also have a good chance of surviving to hit again. Mm. They need a turn or two to heal, but you don't lose half of your army in one go.
Yes, and they also have the advantage of speed.
Yes.
Mostly what you said, but they could also be useful, for example, you want to try to pick someone off before, like a barbarian, before they start ravaging. Although not necessarily with chariots. Like, for me, I like mounted units, but I'd rather build chariots. I'd wait for a horse archer. That's not so much because I think the horse archer is so much better than a chariot, but it's just that there are other priorities at the time when you can build chariots, and by the point I'm thinking, hey, I could use some mounted units to help with defense. Like, for example, the later on you're building a new city, it's like, oh, I need a defender up there. I was worrying about some other things. I was kind of stretched thin for defensive unit or offensive units. I want to get some unit in there as quick as possible. Oh, I'll send a mounted unit because I'll get there twice as faster or somewhere in there. But by then, it's horse archer time.
I guess you don't rush much if you don't build chariots.
No. No.
I think chariots are pretty damn powerful, especially now that they can kill X-Men. They get a big bonus. So, yeah, you can use them to rush or even to just keep off the barbarians if you're playing with the raging hordes. Those are pretty powerful, not overpowered, certainly not underpowered either. Cavalry are pretty useful. And personally, I don't use horse archers all that much. But, yeah, they're good for pillaging or indeed to soften up defenses.
Maybe underutilized would be a better way of putting it. Yeah, they tend to skip over because they see something with his, ooh, it's two things stronger. Let's build that one.
What about the stable improvement? Is it underrated, overrated? Sean Nakamura says that it currently gives 2 experience points to mounted units and costs 60 hammers to build. This is both boring and not ultra useful since horse troops have a limited use. Well, forget that.
Yeah.
Looking at the stable, I think it could use a slight buff. I'm not convinced.
Well, if I didn't have a bunch of other things to build in the city that are laying the game at the same time, I might build them more often and get more use out of them. But if you have them around when you're still building cavalry, that's really nice.
For me, the biggest problem is, I think, like I said, I don't build too many horse archers generally, so I don't prioritize that tech either. And that means I don't get stables until pretty late. If they had a different starting tech, I would probably build them a lot more to give some extra promotion to my chariots. But I think basically the +2 experience is pretty useful. I mean, it's basically an extra promotion that you get right out of the gate. It can make 10-20% difference in combat. Not something to snub.
10 or 20% more win.
Ooh.
Imran?
Yeah.
He has no comment.
Why?
I agree. I think horse units may be underrated by me. I don't particularly use as much, but I think maybe I should use more.
Try to chariot rush someone next game.
There you go.
It's always fun.
And I'll let you know how it goes in about 5 months or so when I do it. Kick levies to the curb.
Yes, finally in the modcast. That was my summary. It was either that or a takeoff on a certain something. Bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry.
What did we say about singing?
No singing.
This guy, 09N07E. Wants to take levies out of the game for 3 reasons. 1, hammers in late game needs to decrease. 2, the dike is too powerful.
4.
Oh, 4. 3, riverside advantage is too much. And 4, AI doesn't consider the big advantage of having levy when building cities. Discuss.
There's such a thing as too much late game hammers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since when?
In late game, production increases like a skyrocket.
It's supposed to.
In modern times, production hasn't increased at all. From the Renaissance era.
I think 18 Llama says this better. Take away extra hammers? I don't want to sound rude, but are you nuts?
I don't want to sound rude, but with your mother, a dropped you on your head a few times and... Oh.
It would be nice if the AI thought of that more often when we're building next to a river. That, ooh, I could build a levee here later. But we know the AI can't think that far ahead.
Well, you can just make it prioritize rivers more.
We'll make it just prefer rivers more, yeah. Would be nice. Keep building one off of a river. Stop it. Stim you one off the coast, one off the river.
DC Bandicoot says that dykes are a bit overpowered, especially with a financial leader.
They're powerful, but if they're so late in the game, I'm not sure that you can call them overpowered. If it was an early game building, then you might have a case.
Drew Ledsoe says, Dyke on a huge map are the most powerful standard building there is. Too powerful. I'd say make Dyke only buildable where you could build a levy. But again, I think that we're talking about later game.
Yeah, I think it, maybe, you know, of course, if you use Advanced Star, then it's maybe also a different story. But for the most part, it comes pretty late in the game. I'm not sure that it's really a huge issue.
I try not to think about Advanced Starts, people.
So. Crazy people.
Riverside advantage is too much. Well, that's why it's an advantage. That's why so many ancient cities were built on a river, because they knew it was an advantage. I think we're getting too much out of the game concept here somewhere.
Precious means we should move on.
Not give them any more attention.
Yes.
Yeah, stop it. No attention for you.
Wow.
It's true. Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was the other surprise. Oh.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659, 301-637-POLLY.
And for Europe, 440-720-7871-7659, 440-720-7871-POLLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
Seriously, where is the hate mail address?
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net. Say more quietly.
Yeah, damn. Seriously.
How does that?
That's what my freaking keyboard makes, damn it.
Shall we move to the Senate?
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
Which starting tech combination is the best? This is quite a poll we've got here.
Yeah, the winner of the polls, well, so far by a good deal, is mining and agriculture.
Well, yeah, farms and mines, hello.
That has 58 votes, which is 28.29% of this poll on CFC. It's followed by mining and mysticism, which has 32 votes to give you an idea of how much mining and agriculture is winning.
I personally like mining and hunting. For me, the most important thing is in the early game to get the resource revealing decks. And of course, mining gets you close to bronze working and iron working. Both hunting and agriculture bring you closer to animal husbandry. But at the same time, I like to play with raging barbarians, and then you also really need archers.
Yes, in that case.
Yeah.
I knew there was a reason.
In that case, you need a hunting early on. So, yeah. I guess if you don't play with raging barbarians, then agriculture probably, because you get farms, slightly bigger advantage there.
Well, that makes an interesting point, too. It depends on what you play with, right?
Yeah.
And it depends on what kind of victory you're going for, because you might want one of the ones, mysticism combos, if you're trying for cultural.
True. Water makes a good point. If you're playing with raging barbarians, well, you might want to go another route, so you don't die early.
Yeah.
But your options matter. It's hard to say what starting tech combo is the best all the time, because you might decide to play with different conditions every time you play. Or if you play with the same conditions all the time, then perhaps you can have one. I tend to try and mix it up sometimes.
If you play on a map with a lot of water, then fishing is definitely something you want to prioritize.
Exactly.
If you have that option, I usually start with workboat first, because that's really powerful if you have a resource like fishing in your first city's radius. But of course, normally on a Pangaea map, yeah, that's not ever going to happen normally. So that makes fishing a lot less useful as a starting tech. That's sort of the key thing. I mean, in different games, depending on your starting condition, if you happen to have pigs or whatever, or horses nearby, you want a different starting tech than when you have deer or, I don't know, stone or marble or whatever. So it depends on what game settings, it depends on what map type, it depends on your starting situation.
And it depends on if you have Montezuma nearby.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a given. Yeah, because I always like having hunting to start with, so I can build scouts and start reconning the area. But, of course, if you're on islands...
Yeah, that makes a little
it's
sense.
It's like, well, I don't really want that. And, great.
That's the third advantage of hunting, yeah. It's a pretty big one as well.
I created a scout on my island. I was able to look at the two tiles over to me.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I've got the scout on my island, and it's discovered a map of the region. Oh, for crying out loud. Hey, looking at all of these starting texts that are listed with fishing, agriculture, hunting, wheel, and mysticism. Mysticism is really the only one that, if I had a choice, I'd rather not start with mysticism. It's the only one that I just...
Because you're a godless fool.
I usually play with random so that I sometimes have mysticism, or with random sieves, so that usually sometimes start with mysticism and sometimes not. I think that's kind of nice. If I have it, I focus on a religion-based strategy, and if I don't start with it, then I don't bother. I wait for someone to spread religion to me. So I could go either way on that one. I like having it sometimes and not having it other times. So.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say if mysticism, if you want to be one of the first two to found a religion, but I'm always usually waiting to be about the third one. Polytheism and meditation, I used to always try to go for those, so I would have loved to have mysticism at that time, but I just banged my head against the wall trying to do that. So I don't necessarily wait for religion to spread to me, but that's not a first priority for me, religion. It's nice, but if you're about to be destroyed, well...
It doesn't help you.
At least I found religion.
Prayer will not save you.
And I noticed there's only one combination that has absolutely nobody so far in this poll of more than 200 votes going for it, and that's the combination of fishing and wheel. That stands out as the only one with zero.
It's not a bad combo, but it's not particularly good either, I guess.
It's kind of an eh.
It's better than mysticism and X.
I guess that's sort of the interesting. There's not really one bad combo in there. They all have their advantages. It's just that some are slightly better than others, depending, of course, on starting position, etc., etc.
Of course, I was really looking for some starting techs like computers, or electricity, or genetics, or gunpowder, or something.
You only get that in Dan mode.
Oh, darn.
Oh, Dan mode.
AKA World Builder.
World Builder.
Let's talk about coal.
Working in a coal mine, going down.
Are you just a coal miner's daughter?
Coal, is it a waste?
No.
With all the new unhealthiness, once I get oil, uranium, my normally windmill, any coal resource in my territory, is there any reason to keep coal other than power plants after you have combustion? It's not whether coal is a waste in general, but whether coal is a waste after you have combustion.
You can still use the hammers.
Yeah, hammers are always good. More hammers, better. Why do they want to kill our hammers?
Exactly. How am I supposed to build my spaceship faster without all these hammers?
Mm-hmm. Bastards.
Quit trying to take my hammers. You can use all those hammers to build the hospitals to offset plus three unhealthy.
Well, like 18 Llama says in the thread, a plain hill with a railroad and nearby river and a levee can even give you 8 hammers, add factory and power and forge, and that's 16 hammers. Add mining incorporated and you get even more bonus hammers. I mean, hammers are nice.
It's not a waste. It has its uses.
An unspoken request is spending too much time managing unhealthiness equals not fun. Building whose only purpose is to provide a few health bonuses are not fun to build.
Well, it's the choice you make. Well, you don't have to have all those hammers. You can forego it.
No, I think this person should talk to that one that wants to take all those hammers away. I think they and the levy person should.
Yeah, they can get together.
Get together, make their mod. No coal, no levies.
I like the one poster, L4ZXXOR. Whatever. Hey, man, go with your moral obligation to protect the environment. Down with coal. Let's burn it all. Wait, that's not what you want. Is anyone going to disagree?
Probably not.
Yeah, I know. I think we all think it still has its use. I don't think there's much discussion on that one, or the next one, necessarily.
Off to G Mover Capital. Once in about 100 games. Maybe.
Yeah. Another topic by Levger.
It's not like Civ 3 where that would actually really give you a bonus to move your capital around if you needed to recenter it, because corruption's gone. It just costs you a little bit more. Woo.
The only real time, if you get, like Levger says, if you get bureaucracy and you want that 50% bonus somewhere else,
But then you have to spend how many turns building the palace just to get that?
Exactly. It ends up being kind of silly.
Unless you started with a capital that's mostly food or is in a kind of a bad location and you found a better place to move a capital to.
Mm.
But that, how often does that happen?
Yeah.
Not very.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever moved my capital in Civ 4.
I like Steve the Noble's response. I don't think I've ever moved it on purpose.
Ooh, a palace. Shiny. Wait a second. That moves my capital.
He said, I think back in Civ 3, maybe even Civ 1, I accidentally had it in the build queue for some small, crappy city on the outskirts of my empire.
I think I did that too when I didn't know what a palace was. I was like, wait a second, my capital?
I think there used to be some strategy, it might have been Civ 3 or Civ 2, but you saved up your shield in the palace while you were on the last two or three turns of researching a tech that you wanted to build a wonder with, so you could sort of get started in advance. And then you'd forget or not get it, and your palace would move.
Well, has anyone really made a strategy of moving their capital here?
Never.
My capital only gets moved when I get attacked.
Yeah. Oops.
Yeah.
Build the capital. Build the capital. Do it quickly.
Politan University.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We do have that.
If people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for comparative playing to have other people give you advice. That's the Apollon University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Apollon.net.
Really?
Forums?
Wow. How can I figure that out?
I don't know.
Apollon University. Sometimes I wonder.
Polycast celebrates its 1-year anniversary. Woohoo! To celebrate that, we decided to give you a present by working extra hard to improve the show. We're conducting a survey in our forums to see what you like and don't like about the show, so we can use that to make it even better. Right now, we have polls going about our favorite host, favorite guest, and your preferred episode length. More polls like this will be posted in the future, so please vote and chime in on the discussion to let us know how to make your listening experience better. You can do this by going to polycast.apoliton.net and following the links in the survey section, or go to the apoliton/community forum directly and find the relevant threads.
Unnerf the barbarians, Dankus.
I know. They should be. And they should be unnerfed and be able to flourish and prosper and all sorts of fun stuff like that. Because then Barbarian discovers a wonder and suddenly everyone's like, what? And then they all go, they go out and try to get that city, and it's like a free-for-all trying to get that city. Everyone's kind of piling in there. So that's kind of fun, I would assume. By the way, this one also ties in with the next topic you have as well from Civ Fanatics about Barbarian Vassal.
Yes.
Who is Sid?
That's the best part.
In our Nerf the Barbarian movement, we can add this as well. Liberating, and he gets a Barbarian of Celtia as his new vassal. I like the animated figurehead is Sid in a Firaxis t-shirt with a halo coming and going from time to time. I like the fact that he gave himself a halo.
You know what that means, right? It founded a religion.
Mm-hmm.
China Blue, she said that she was going to send me questions for Mackie to answer on the show, but she never sent me questions. China Blue, what's going on?
What?
I think she's just a plant.
What?
A plant? Oh, no.
What?
I don't know. Someone's just trying to make Dan all jealous and stuff. Mm-hmm. Compliments Splatter and wants to send questions to Mackie.
And that made a plant.
Uh-huh. You've been listening to the 31st edition of Polycast, the official podcast of Polton Civilization site. I am Imran Siddiqui, and I am joined by Water Snyders.
Bye.
Known as the cutest on the forums. I've also been joined with Maki, your favorite host, according to the poll.
I am more popular than you.
We knew that already.
Bye.
Then Q as well.
Bye.
And we also had Snoopy369. We like to call him Joe because he reminds us of a glorious cup of Joe in the morning, waking us up from our doldrums.
But he decided he had real life to attend to, and therefore could not join us for this closing. He's too good for us. But thank you for listening, and hopefully you'll listen again, or at least have us on in the background while you do something random.
Yeah, speaking of things, why don't we talk about episode length? Number... No. Record date, October 27th, 2007. America Pie clip by Don McLean, copyright United Artists. Working in a Coal Mine clip by Devo, copyright Warner Brothers Records. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization 4 Warlords and Beyond the Sword. Copyright 2007, a Poulton Civilization site at apoulton.net.